He'd love it.
Garrett, for some reason, hasn't really shed certain strange juvenile habits, like secretly eating cherry chapstick and raw pasta. Not necessarily together. "It's good," I tell him with a smile. Unfortunately, Dad always knows when I'm lying, but I'm sure he appreciates the gesture. After a few minutes of awkward crunching, Basil goes ahead and breaks the silence. "At least the water's cold," he says, which makes everyone crack up, eventually growing into uncontrollable giggles. It's the kind of laughter that forces its way out like a bad case of hiccups. It makes me feel a little bit better, and though at first I just kind of played with my food, the more I eat, the more the meal is starting to grow on me. That's when the lights suddenly flicker off, and then back on again. It was only dark for a second, maybe not even that, but it's enough to make everyone stop eating. Everyone is frozen. What's that expression? Waiting for the other shoe to drop? But it doesn't. The lights are on. They stay on. But it doesn't change the fact that they blinked. And now all the clocks angrily think that it's 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 12 o'clock. I finally look to Dad, and I see for the first time my father truly starting to worry. It's that maybe I should see a doctor face, a line I've only heard him say once, 5 minutes before he was rushed to the hospital with appendicitis. So now we all sit there, silent, forks in hand, trapped at the dinner table. And for some reason, I can't bring myself to look anyone else in the eye, so I put my head down and I eat. After a few seconds, I realize that everyone else is doing the same, shoveling food into their mouths like scared animals. And it goes on like that until our plates are empty. Not because we're that hungry, but because none of us wants to see that look on Dad's face again. I'm just getting ready for bed a few hours later when I hear movement outside. Uncle Basil. My bedroom window looks out into the street, so I have the luxury of hearing his every coming and going. I check the clock. Midnight is a strange time for Basil to go anywhere. I travel downstairs, and when I get there, I find him loading up the back of his truck.
"I didn't want to wake you," he says, already seeming guilty about something.
"You're leaving?" I ask. He looks to me warmly.
"It'll just be for a few nights," he says, though the giant suitcase full of clothes tells me otherwise.
Just like with Sophia.
"Besides," he continues, "I've already eaten you out of house and home. I don't want to use up all of your guys' water, too."
Uncle Basil has always been a little sensitive about having to stay with us this past year, and this whole tap-out thing is another added dimension to his dependence on us. But I think the power threatening to go out was the straw that broke the camel's back.
"Where are you going?" I ask.
"Daphne's place. She's still in that big house over in Dove Canyon. Says they still have water there. Not sure how long that'll last, though, but at least it's something," he says, looking down.
I smirk. "Are you talking about the water or you and Daphne?"
He chuckles. "Either or," he says.
Daphne is his on-again, off-again girlfriend. They'd been together since before his farm failed. They moved down here right at the beginning of the Big Bale, which is what they called the mass exodus from the Central Valley's farming communities. Daphne always refused to allow us to call him Uncle Basil in her presence. It was all Herb, all the time, which makes me think that deep down, she really does love him, even though they keep breaking up.
"Well," I say, "I hope the tap out helps bring you two back together."
"She's not doing it for me," he admits. "She's doing it for you."
"Me?"
"All of you. To keep me from being a burden on your mom and dad."
"You're not a burden."
He smiles. "Thanks for saying so, Alyssa."
I give him a tight hug goodbye and watch him drive off.
Then I go back inside, sad to see him leave like this, but at the same time, a little less worried than before. The fact that there's running water anywhere gives me hope that things might not be so bad after all.
Snapshot, KZLA News. Tensions rise as the Southland enters the third day of the tapout, but government officials say relief is on the way. Local Eyewitness News anchor Lila Singh reads her part, then defers to Chase Buxton, her co-anchor, who recites his line from the teleprompter. Meanwhile, the cascade effect that has left more than 23 million people without running water shows no sign of abating. For more, we take you to Donovan Lee in Silver Lake. As they cut away from the studio to the empty concrete reservoir that used to be Silver Lake, Lila reflects on the trials of her day. Getting to the studio from the Hollywood Hills was a nightmare. She had nearly missed the mid-morning update, and now it looks like the news will be preempting more and more programming, which means she won't be going home anytime soon. "Did you hear the head of FEMA was ignoring the governor's calls?" one of the cameramen had told her earlier. "No joke. Hurricane Noah is the only thing on FEMA's radar right now." At that moment, their producer had passed by and admonished them both, as if Lila had been doing anything more than just listening. "We deal in news, people, not rumors." The control booth cuts back to the studio from the Silver Lake report, and Lila quickly brings her thoughts back to the here and now. "Thank you, Donovan. In the midst of the mayhem, earlier today, the governor had this to say." They roll a tape that the station has been playing over and over throughout the day, and Lila listens for the umpteenth time, still trying to figure out if there's anything in the governor's voice betraying a deeper truth that he hasn't shared with the press. "Federal emergency management is aware of the situation," the governor says, "and we are told that tankers of potable water are on their way from as far as Wyoming to satisfy Southern California's immediate critical need." Wyoming? Thinks Lila. How long will it take water trucks to get here from Wyoming? "I want to assure the people of Southern California," continues the governor, "that help is on the way. Mobile desalination plants are going to be in place up and down the coast to turn seawater into drinking water. Everything possible is being done to alleviate this situation. Thank you." Then he leaves, as always dodging a barrage of questions. The camera's red lights blink on, catching Lila a little bit off guard. But she's a professional. Rather than stumbling, she just pauses, making the moment seem intentional. "At this time," she reads, "everyone is advised to stay indoors to avoid heatstroke and stay tuned for more information." "That's right, Lila," Chase says. "And everyone should refrain from any sort of strenuous activity." "Exactly. The best way to conserve water right now is to hold on to the water your body already has." There were two full pitchers of ice water in Lila's dressing room when she arrived that morning. Just thinking about them now makes her want a nice, tall glass. "We'll be back right after this." They cut to a commercial. Lila relaxes, looking at her briefings of the upcoming stories. How the zoo is handling the tap out. A man who was shot while trying to get water from a tanker truck heading for a hospital, and, just breaking now, the first official death from dehydration in San Bernardino. Chase turns to her, raising an eyebrow. "This is bad," he says, with the same vocal inflection with which he might have said, "This is fresh," back in the days when he was a voice actor on fast food commercials, although rumor had it that he did other sorts of work. But, like their producer said, they deal in news, not rumors. "And yet all we do is tell people to stay calm and keep watching." "What are we supposed to tell them? Go scream bloody murder naked through the streets?" "If it'll help them get through this, then yes." "Well," Chase says, with an irksome smirk, "that would make quite the story." When the afternoon report is over, Lila goes to her dressing room only to find that both pitchers are empty. Someone, or maybe multiple people, has pilfered her water. "More is on the way," a nervous intern promises. 10 minutes, max." But 10 minutes later, neither the water nor the intern are anywhere to be found. In the hallway, Chase is on the line with his agent, the speakerphone blaring his personal business to anyone who cares. The agent's telling him that if he handles this just right, this crisis could propel him to the national stage, a spot on CNN maybe. "I hate that you're using this as your personal pole vault," Lila tells him. Chase just shrugs and continues his conversation. While Lila has her own career ambitions, she's not the jackal that Chase is, scavenging a future from the bones of the present. She looks out a window, trying to get a true view of this crisis from 43 stories up. Down below, there are crowds in the street. Are they demonstrating? Is it water distribution? From this high up, she can't tell. Suddenly, she feels claustrophobic in this tower, isolated. Then, more reports of dehydration deaths begin to roll in as the afternoon churns on. They come fast and furious, and she knows they have to report them, and can only imagine what it would be like on the listening end, trapped in your neighborhood, wondering if someone on your street is going to be next. And all this time, no water comes to her dressing room. Chase is dry, too. There doesn't seem to be water for anyone, and no one's promising anything anymore. That's when she gets an idea. It's a long shot, but it's the only idea she's got. "Put me in Sky 3 Chopper," she tells her producer. "What?" He looks at her as if she's become delirious. "Lila, you're an anchor. You haven't done an aerial report since your days covering traffic." "Riots, fires, and gridlock. The stories aren't in here. They're out there. People will respond to it," she says, pretending that, like Chase, this is all about ambition. "An anchor in the sky will hold their attention, keep them on us instead of switching channels." "No," he tells her. "I need you at your desk." But once he's gone, she goes to the roof anyway. Sky 3 Chopper is on the helipad as the traffic reporter's shifts are changing. For a moment, she flashes to Vietnam, where some of the best reporting ever took place. Of course, it was long before she was born. But she can't help but look at that helicopter and imagine what it must have been like for those reporters desperately waiting to get airlifted out as Saigon fell. Kurt, the same pilot who used to take her out in her early days with the station, leans against the stairwell shaft, having a smoke, which is not allowed so close to the chopper, but he doesn't care. She's hoping that's not the only rule he doesn't care about. "Kurt, what's the range of your chopper?" "About 250 on a full tank," he tells her. "Right now, probably closer to 200. Why?" She takes a deep breath. "I need a favor." 5 minutes later, they're soaring away from downtown L.A., heading east. And once she feels they've put enough distance between themselves and the newsroom, she texts her producer. "Taking Sky 3 to Arrowhead. We'll report on refugee situation." She sends it, thinks for a moment, then texts, "Cover for me. Or fire me." There. It's done. Whatever happens now, she'll be in one of the few places that still has water. The high lakes might be below their usual water line, but they're still lakes. She takes a deep, relieved breath, feeling a sense of connection to her fellow journalists all those years ago as they boarded helicopters halfway around the world to escape the Viet Cong. Day 3. Monday, June 6th. 4. Kelton.
No school today. No news on when classes will resume. With just 2 weeks left to the school year, I wonder if we'll be going back at all. I try to keep busy by flipping through comic books, but for some reason they don't feel engaging today. I search online for hunting gear to add to my Christmas wish list. Still not gripping my attention. So, I go to watch YouTube videos of chess boxing, a hybrid fighting sport where you alternate between chess and a round of boxing. It's the one non-weapon-related sport that I excel in. It's also the only thing that's landed me in disciplinary Saturday school in my entire high school career. Because after doing an oral report on it in English last year, I was cornered by a trio of non-believers and forced to demonstrate the boxing aspect on one of their noses. I would have pummeled them in chess, too, but was hauled into the dean's office. I watch a couple of videos, but today, Even chess boxing is no match for how listless I feel. It's more than that, though. I'm troubled about the state of the world outside, even considering how prepared we are. It started when Burnside showed up at our door with a gift. Sure, I love the idea of our family's arch-enemies turning into sycophantic suck-ups, but when the strange actually materializes into reality, it definitely leaves you reeling. Much like that what-now feeling when you look into the dark eyes of the first stag you brought down, or the triumphant despair of shooting a game duck out of the air, only for it to fall down a cliff, never to be retrieved for all of eternity. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that everything can be effectively related to hunting. I mean, they do say our every action and inaction is related to some primordial fight-or-flight hardwiring. For example, winning the affection of a girl is a lot like shooting a deer. It's important that you approach slowly and with caution, and preferably from a posterior angle, where they have little to no vision. Women, like deer, can be scared away by a strong musk, which is why it's important to always wear deodorant. Dressing in camouflage doesn't hurt either, because, in my experience, girls find camouflage really cool. But all of that aside, I think the most important aspect of obtaining a girl of the opposite sex is knowing when to pull the trigger. Metaphorically, that is. You gotta make your move when it feels right, or else you'll come off as creepy. This I know from experience, too. But when it comes to my next-door neighbor, Alyssa Morrow, she feels like the deer I've never been able to shoot. Like I'm so close to making a move, or at least telling her how I feel, but for some reason, the moment never feels right. I always figured that if I was in the right place, the right time would present itself. So this year, I hacked the school computer and arranged to get 5 of my 6 classes with her. I would have done all 6, but that would have been too obvious. On this particular morning, Alyssa's finishing up yard work out front. It looks like she's trying to siphon water out of their irrigation system, but that's not going to work. Judging by their brown lawn, their sprinklers have been dry for months, just like most everyone else's. As far as timing goes, I'm starting to get the feeling that it's now or never. So I slip on a desert camouflage tactical vest and head next door. I step outside and locate Alyssa heading toward her garage, struggling to carry some tools. I have positioning to my advantage, so I flank left. As I near, I swallow hard, my nerves making my throat go thick. "Need any help?" I manage to get out. I realize it's the exact same thing I said the other day when they were unloading their ice. I'm hoping she appreciates consistency. "That's okay, I think I got it." Though clearly she doesn't. Perhaps she's trying not to look weak in front of me. So I push forward. "Here, let me at least grab these for you," I say as I take a few wrenches and store them in my pocket. Cargo shorts are essential. Girls love a guy with lots of pockets. "Thanks," she says, as we put the tools away in their respective places in the garage. That's when I catch a whiff of something nasty coming from the house. I must wrinkle my nose because she notices it and looks away, as if I might think the smell is coming from her. "Septic problems?" I ask. "We think sewer gas is backing up into our house because of the lack of water," she tells me. "My dad's working on some plumbing modifications to stop it." This, I knew, was inevitable. Probably every house in the neighborhood but ours will be smelling the same right about now. But not everyone seems as diligent about doing something about it as Alyssa and her family. Of course, they're going about it all wrong. "All you need is zero evaporation trap seal liquid. Pour about a cup into every drain, and no sewer gas can get through." And then I add, "It's the stuff they use in waterless urinals." She makes an ew face at me, and I realize that was too much information. "Anywho," I say, stumbling over my words a bit and looking away involuntarily. "I can give you a bottle. We've got plenty of it." Which is true, but when my dad finds out I gave it away, he'll chew me a new one. But it's worth it, because Alyssa lights up. "Thanks, Kelton, that's really generous of you." And after seeing her smile like that at me, something compels me to go all in. I hold out my canteen to her. "Here, have some," I say, You look thirsty. She cautiously takes the canteen. Are you sure? She asks. I shrug like it's nothing. What are friends for? She takes a few gulps and hands it back. Then I take a swig. Alyssa and I just shared a canteen. Considering the saliva exchange involved, that's almost like kissing. I suppress a little shiver at the thought. Thank you, Kelton, she says again. Then we stand there in silence. But for the first time, the silence that lingers between us feels a little more natural. It feels good. Without warning, Garrett appears out of what feels like thin air and snatches the canteen from me. Thanks, Kelton, he teases. Don't be rude, Alyssa says. That's not yours. Just then, their father enters with a box of dirty rags, and her mother just a few moments later. She smiles, barely able to contain herself. News says there'll be desalination machines along the coast. They'll have a few up and running down at Laguna Beach by this afternoon. What's a desalination machine? Garrett asks. It converts salt water into fresh water, I tell him. They've actually got a big plant down in San Diego, but it's not going to help us. Truth be told, it won't help San Diego much either now. It was forward-thinking of them to build it a few years back, so for once it's not a case of too little too late. Instead, it's too little right on time. Because at full capacity, it can provide enough water for 8% of San Diego's population, less than 1 in 10 people, not the solution they hoped it would be. Alyssa's father wipes sweat from his brow. We pay big taxes to fund organizations like FEMA. It's about time they stepped in and did something.
Well, it's not like they can just let us die of thirst, her mother adds, as if this notion were preposterous, but then waits for someone to chime in with validation.
Her father nods in agreement. It's a matter of numbers, he says. After all, California is one of the largest work economies. They need us, and I don't think they would be so stupid as to neglect us.
Her father's words stick with me, and though they have merit, I can't help but hear my own father's voice echoing in my head, complaining about the thousands of cumulative mistakes that have led us to this point. The failed consumer rebates, conservation councils, and radical attempts to save water, like the millions of black shade balls Los Angeles released into reservoirs to prevent evaporation, which did nothing. And now, I can't decide whether we're headed toward a real solution, or if we're desperately throwing water bottles at the problem. I open my mouth to raise such questions, but then suddenly stop myself, remembering what my father always told me about the sheep, their behavior, how their main instinct is to follow members of the herd directly ahead of them, and how being thrown off course, even the slightest bit, would elicit an overwhelming, primordial sense of panic that can be deadly. I did a current events presentation once about a flock of 500 sheep somewhere in Turkey that plummeted to their deaths one by one in a ravine, because each sheep followed the one directly ahead of it, never comprehending the bigger picture. Which is worse, I wonder, watching everyone you know fall into that ravine, or shaking their reality with such force that it ruins them?
5. Alyssa.
Today, the toilet is really getting back at us for all the years of cruel and unsanitary labor. It's been making strange gurgling sounds and expelling 6-month-old rotten egg smells. So our current mission is to clean the toilet bowls the best we can, and then pour in 2 cups of Kelton's Trap Seal liquid stuff so our house can smell like a house again and less like a spiteful septic tank. And as supreme ruler of the household, Dad has elected Garrett and me to take care of the toilets. This morning, Dad has taken the liberty of delegating tasks through passive-aggressive post-it notes hidden like Easter eggs all over the house. One on the fridge says, 6 cups of water per day. Another on our shower reads, dry bathing only, which consists of shower gel and paper towels. But I think the worst one of all is the clean me, please, post-it just above the toilets. Dad craftily installed bags under each toilet seat, which we are to throw out after using, like a giant camping nightmare. The bag thing is manageable, but having to actually clean the bowl in its current state is just cruel and unusual punishment. Garrett and I start with the downstairs bathroom, seeing as our water is stored in the bathtub adjacent to the toilet. I take a look into the bathtub and realize that the water line has really receded since Saturday. This morning, Mom discreetly gave away a couple of gallons to some friends around the corner. With desalination units being set up along the coast, she figures there'll be enough water for everyone soon enough, so why not be generous? If it were up to me, I'd probably do the same. How are we supposed to clean a toilet if we can't use water? Garrett asks as he crams his hands into those yellow cleaning gloves that squeak when you rub your fingers together. Dad said the cleaning supplies are under the sink. I'm sure you can figure it out. I pinch my nostrils together and dare myself to look into the toilet bowl. Black liquid bubbles to the surface. Why do I have to do it? He nags. Because we're taking turns, I remind him, then appeal to his male ego. Plus, you're a guy. You're naturally going to be better than me at plumbing. He nods in accordance, clearly satisfied to hear me say he's better than me at something. Then he fishes under the sink for the cleaning supplies. Bleach will do, I tell him. He eventually settles on the green canister of Powdered Comet, a bleach-based multi-purpose cleaner, and goes to set it on the edge of the bathtub. The moment its bottom touches the edge, I can already see the worst-case scenario playing in my head. But it isn't until he lets go of the comet that my worst fear materializes into reality. The container, sitting precariously on the uneven edge, begins to slip. My heart quicksteps. Garrett! I yell, which is all I can manage to get out. He spins around, and before he's even able to grasp the situation, the container of powdered bleach has already slipped down the side of the tub and splashed into the water. He looks back to me, his face completely drained of color. And next comes the most torturous of silences. He quickly goes for the comet, but it slips from his grasp, only to float farther away. The water is already clouding with a swirling murk of poisonous multi-purpose cleanser, and then reality finally hits me. Garrett has just tainted the only water we have. Maybe we can save some of it, he says, as he finally grasps the comet can and pulls it out of the water upside down, dumping even more liquefying powder into the tub. It's already contaminated, idiot, I tell him sharply. It's your fault, he snaps. You told me to use the bleach. You've always been a klutz. Do you have any idea what you just did? But instead of coming back with another defense, his face constricts, his eyes take on a shiny squint, and tears begin to seep out, his body giving way to hopelessness. My sisterly conscience kicks in, and I'm suddenly wishing I could take back my words. I'm sorry, he says through snivels, burying his face in his hands. It's okay, I tell him, and I give him a hug, something I realize I haven't done in a long time. We have the desalination machines down by the beach. Mom and Dad are going to stock up, remember? Garrett nods, collecting himself. Drinking from the bathtub was totally disgusting anyway, I say, and he laughs, disrupting the tears long enough to bring him back from despair. I agree that I'll be the one to tell Mom and Dad about what happened to the bathwater, because Garrett argued that it would sound better coming from me. Of course, the real reason is that he's too afraid to break the news to them himself. For some reason, he thinks our parents are a lot scarier than they really are. But then again, this isn't the routine spoiled dinner, stink bomb, or broken window. I'll tell them, but I won't take the blame, I say to Garrett. I know it was an accident, but you still have to own up to it. Because what kind of sister would I be if I didn't teach him the importance of taking responsibility? I go downstairs to tell Mom and Dad, bracing for the worst, but they don't get angry, which I soon realize is much worse than if they had. All of it, Dad says, as if there were a way to divide the comet water from the drinkable water. It wasn't Garrett's fault, I tell them, even though it was. He was just trying to clean the toilet, like you told him. I expect Mom to say something like, "Don't you go putting this back on us," but she doesn't even return my slow lob. This isn't just a screw-up, I realize. It's an event. Events bypass anger, straight to damage control. We still have the pitcher in the fridge, Mom says, looking at Dad. Dad nods. The desalination rigs should be up and running sometime today. We'll head out there as soon as we can. Maybe we can boil the water in the tub, one pot at a time, I suggest, and collect the steam. We made a distillery like that back in 7th grade as part of a science lab. As I recall, we barely managed to get a test tube of water out of it, but I'll bet Kelton could make a functional one. Did I actually just think about asking Kelton for help? That's a project for another day, Dad says, already overwhelmed with the weight of the news I just delivered. I'm sorry, I tell them. It sucks, and I'm sorry. Don't cry over spilt milk, honey, says Mom. Or poisoned water, adds Dad, which makes me grimace, but I press my lips tight so they can't see. I go upstairs to notify Garrett that he won't be put up for adoption, sent to a forced labor camp, or cooked into meat pies, but he's nowhere to be found. I check the bathroom, the backyard, and even the garage, and that's when I notice that his bike is missing. He took off without telling anyone, so afraid of what Mom and Dad would do. Mom and Dad drop everything to find Garrett. They want us to split up and systematically search every place he might go. They're a little more worried than I thought they'd be. They're always overreacting when it comes to Garrett. He was born a month premature, and it sent my parents into this eternal, hypersensitive protection mode. Even to this day, if he so much as gets a scratch, it's like they've got the hospital on speed dial for an emergency skin graft. I try to tell myself that it's just my parents being parents, but today I can't help but worry a little, considering the circumstances. I agree to check the parks where he and his friends like to hang out and the bike trail that runs parallel to the freeway. I go to get my bike, but both tires are flat since I haven't really used the thing in years, and the tires don't take air now, no matter how much I pump. All that's left is Garrett's GoPed, which I have no idea how to use, and a pogo stick, which was clearly invented by Satan right after he invented the unicycle. So after exhausting all options, I realize that I'm going to have to ask Kelton for some neighborly help. Maybe he'll let me borrow a bike or create a workaround out of bubblegum and earwax. I ring the doorbell and he answers, almost too quickly. No time for small talk. I get right to the point. I have a favor to ask. Garrett's missing, and I need a bike. Rather than being weird, he responds like a regular human being. You can use my dad's, he says. I'll go get it. He goes back in and meets me at the side gate. It's a nice bike. Then I realize that he's bringing his own bike out as well. Two heads are better than one, he says. And it's really not a good idea for you to be out on your own right now. Things might look quiet, but it's always that way right before a storm. Scratch the normal human being thing. That's okay, Kelton. You don't have to come. The cost of borrowing my dad's bike is letting me come with you. He's not mincing words any more than I am, and clearly he's not negotiating. Fine, I tell him. Actually, I don't really mind, considering he's officially been moved down from orange to yellow on the threat to my sanity scale. We start with the back trails, which eventually spits us back out to the main road near Garrett's school, my high school being just across the street, which gives rise to the thought that maybe he's hiding in the last place we'd expect, the place he despises more than cauliflower and piano lessons combined, Meadow Creek Elementary School. I lean left, redirecting my bike's trajectory. But before I can even turn, a truck flies by, nearly running us over. At first, I find myself pissed that someone could drive so recklessly, but as soon as I realize what kind of truck it is, my spine stiffens, and without even thinking, my legs stop pedaling. It's a camouflage green, open-top military truck, packed with armed soldiers. My first thought is stupid. The kind of thing you think before your mind has time to run it past your brain. What the hell? Did my parents call the freaking National Guard? Quiet before the storm, is all Kelton says. My brain has kicked in by now, and I realize that this is much bigger than my AWOL brother. It's pretty disturbing to see war machines traverse the neighborhood you grew up in. And if that's not troubling enough, the truck turns left, directly into the high school parking lot. What do you think's going on? I ask Kelton, hoping that his extensive knowledge of useless military factoids will come in handy. I don't know, he says. It's too soon for martial law. English, please? It's when the military takes over, he says. It means that government brass thinks the local police can't handle the situation by themselves. Well, that would be a good thing, right? I say, really wanting to convince myself. I push back into the seat of the bike. It means we'll be safer. Kelton attempts to smile. Could be, he says, even though I get the feeling he doesn't believe it could be a good thing at all. Maybe. Maybe. I'm so sick of maybe. Maybe it's martial law. Maybe FEMA will bring in water trucks. Maybe everything will be fine tomorrow. Living in this world of complete uncertainty is more and more frustrating. So I ride forward and follow the transport truck. It's not just that I'm angry. It's because I have to know. I need to kill the maybe. Kelton is on the same wavelength because he's pedaling right behind me. We ride past Lower Campus, the football stadium, and then the tennis courts, just waiting to see where the truck will stop. But it isn't until we pass the aquatic center that we get our answer. It's not just one truck, but a whole bunch of military vehicles. They've got the swimming pool on total lockdown, because high school pools were the only ones that were excluded from the frivolous use initiative. They're the only pools left that still have water. The perimeter of the aquatic center is now guarded by soldiers with automatic rifles. And spidering into the pool are a dozen thick fire hoses, which seem to be sucking up water and depositing it into a series of tanker trucks. Then one of the military guards spots us and locks eyes. I don't look away, but I don't get any closer either. It's like somehow I'm the enemy. I should have guessed it, Kelton says, upset himself for not knowing everything in the history of everything. Those idiots think we're going to drink that? I laugh. I have friends on the water polo team. I've heard stories. They'd have to pay me to drink that water. If they can filter the salt and fish guts and whale turds out of ocean water, I'm sure they can manage anything left behind by the water polo meatheads, Kelton says. And for some reason, this strikes a chord, piquing a memory. Something that Garrett said when we were pushing that broken cart in Costco. I gasp, and Kelton looks to me wondering why. Garrett's friend Jason has a huge fish tank. I'll bet he went to his house to ask for water from it. Though Garrett's always been hard on himself, he was never much of a sulker, so it makes perfect sense that he'd try to fix the situation rather than run from it. I reach for my phone and realize I don't have it.
I left it to charge on my nightstand. Stupid. Can I borrow your phone? I should tell my parents. They can get there quicker. He hands me the phone, but after a few moments of blankly staring at the screen, I realize that I don't even know my parents' numbers. In fact, I don't know anyone's number by heart, except my stupid eighth grade boyfriend's, who is the last person on this or any other planet that I'd call. I don't want to admit to Kelton my current uselessness, so I just say, "We're not that far. Let's just go." We circle the block that Jason lives on twice. "You don't know where he lives, do you?" "Just shut up, okay?" I snap, because I only kinda sorta know where Jason lives. "There's a huge tree in the front yard," I tell him, "like ridiculously huge." But there are no trees that big anywhere. "I'm sure it's this street," I say after the third time around. Kelton thinks about it. "So let's do some detective work," he says. "If the tree was that big, it probably was a huge violation of association rules. And believe me, my family knows about that because everything we do is a violation." "Your point?" "My point is, not everybody doubles down on their violations." I finally get it. "A stump! We're looking for a stump! And five houses up, there it is!" Kelton smiles, pleased with himself. Under other circumstances, it might have been annoying, but he deserves a moment here. Someone else might have just thought I was lying, or not remembering, but he accepted that I was telling the truth and went from there. "That was pretty clever," I admit to him as we head to the house. He shrugs with false modesty. "Just a simple deduction." That's when my own simple deduction is confirmed, because on closer inspection, I can see Garrett's bike behind a dead hedge near the front door. We hop off our bikes and approach the house. The door is ajar. It feels weird knocking on a door that's already partially open, but I do. No response, so I push it open all the way. I go in, and Kelton follows. There's a smell here. Awful. Rotten. "Could be a dead body," Kelton whispers. I ignore him. The living room looks pretty normal, except for the gaudy Roman statue with the leaf-covered genitalia. No accounting for taste. "I don't think anyone's home." Screw it. I cross the living room, heading deeper into the house. "Garrett?" I call out. No response. "Anyone home?" Kelton hesitates. "You know, it's perfectly legal to shoot someone for breaking and entering." "Fine. You can say, 'Told you so,' when I'm dead." Kelton initially follows behind me, but then he pushes his way in front, as if just remembering that Eagle Scouts probably shouldn't hide behind girls. We continue down a hallway. The farther we get, the stranger the carpet underneath my feet begins to feel, the squishier it becomes. It's wet, and the smell is worse than before. That's when something catches my eye. A tropical fish. No, dozens of them. All dead, spread across the floor of the family room. I look up and realize why. The giant fish tank is broken. The enormous aquarium reaches all the way to the ceiling. The collections of rocks and coral that once were a part of the aquatic ecosystem still intact. This is definitely the tank that Garrett was talking about. I move closer to get a better look. A large portion of the tank's face has been smashed in, violently drained of all its water. That is, except a thin layer at the bottom, maybe an inch, where a small clownfish sucks in water helplessly, its body partially exposed to the air. I pick it up and move it to another area of the tank, where it has a better chance at survival. "It was like this when I got here," says a voice from behind. I spin around, and there's Garrett, standing in the kitchen doorway. "And it's salt water, anyway."
I'm happy to have found him. But it isn't long until 1,000 thoughts cascade through my head, bursting the levees that maintain my patience. Then what are you still doing here? I say sharply, realizing that I'm pissed he would send us on a wild goose chase in the first place. Dad said he needed more pasta sauce, so I figured I'd borrow a bottle or two, he explains, avoiding the important questions, as he always does. He looks down and kicks an invisible rock. Can't leave empty-handed, you know. You have Mom and Dad worried sick. You had us all worried sick, I tell him, which I'm sure he already knows. I exhale my aggravation and look around the room, taking in the whole bizarre scene. So what the hell happened here? Garrett shrugs. I think they skipped town and someone must have broken in. Well, says Kelton, looking around at all the dead fish. They definitely didn't come for sushi. It might have been borderline funny in a different situation. Kelton then reaches down and picks up a shard of glass. He holds it up as if to inspect it, the shard glimmering in a ray of light. And that's when I notice what he already has. There's blood on the glass. Let's leave, Garrett says. Kelton and I don't need a second invitation. We don't even bother to take the pasta sauce. Once we're back, Mom and Dad don't punish Garrett, which in itself worries me a little. Instead, they're scouring the house for empty gallon jugs to bring to the desalination machines. You think they'll let us get more than 2 gallons? Mom says to whoever's listening, her head stuck in the pantry. We can always go back for more, Dad yells, probably from a closet somewhere. Garrett emerges from the door to the garage with a large container usually reserved for camping trips. Will this work? Absolutely, Mom says. Garrett, in light of not being punished, is now trying his best to be a perfect son. I give it 5 minutes, tops. Take care of your brother, Mom says to me. And be careful of the McCrackens. Remember, they invented 10-foot poles for people like that. Dad swings through the kitchen and grabs the car keys from the bowl on the counter. Listen to your mother, he says, having no idea what she even said. Kelton's not so bad, I say, suddenly realizing how strange that sounds coming out of my mouth. Mom and Dad, with empty jugs under their arms, make their way toward the door. Well, his older brother got out of there the second he could. His shoes left skid marks on the doorstep, Dad says. Garrett holds the door for them graciously, and Mom kisses him on the head. See you in a bit, I say with a smile. They take Mom's Prius, since Dad's car is still convalescing in the garage. It's moments like these, seeing them together, that make me appreciate the family I have. When you're a teenager, you spend so much time complaining about how lame your parents are, and then they always somehow seem to find a way to remind you that they're actually not as uncool as you want to believe. And now, with the two of them gone, for some odd childlike reason, I find myself wishing I could have given them a hug goodbye.
Six. Kelton.
I decided not to tell my father about the military trucks we saw at our high school. It's not that I don't think it's a significant development, but seeing that we haven't yet been able to get in touch with my older brother, Brady, there's no point in rocking the proverbial boat if we're just going to wait here for him anyway, rather than take off to our bug out in the mountains. With my dad, the embers of Armageddon will quickly grow into a full-on blazing apocalypse in his head. He already got that crazy look in his eyes after hearing about the closures of so many school districts. Which, by the way, is no tragedy to me. Not that I hate school, it's just that, when it comes down to it, I learn more just hanging out at home anyway. I'd probably be homeschooled if either of my parents had the patience to do it. To take my mind off of things, I load up my paintball gun and practice in the backyard. I'm hitting every target on point, and I try to tell myself it's a good omen. The desal rigs down at the beach will do their job. No one will go thirsty. All will be well. My dad steps out onto the patio.
Don't forget to exhale with your shot, he says.
He knows his stuff. After all, he did spend 12 years in the Marine Corps. My mom likes to make fun of his career as a jarhead, his extraction missions, because technically, he worked as a military dentist and never actually left his base. After a few more shots, my CO2 cartridge runs out. I go inside to change it, and right after I finish loading the new cartridge, there's a knock on the front door. My dad answers it. It's Roger Malecki, one of our other neighbors. The Maleckis just had a baby, so we never see them much. Actually, we never saw them much before the baby either. We're not exactly social butterflies in our family.
How are things, Roger?
My dad says pleasantly.
Ugh, don't ask, Malecki says. The car keeps overheating, plus we're having problems with sewage. Whole house stinks.
I hear ya, says my dad. You know, the Morrows next door had the exact same problem. Although, he doesn't offer Malecki any trap seal liquid. Then, Malecki begins to avoid eye contact. My father has no patience for beating around the bush.
What can I do you for, Roger?
Malecki heaves a sigh.
It's the baby. Hannah's still able to feed her, but she's getting dehydrated. I'm afraid she won't be able to breastfeed much longer. We have some powdered formula, but that's kind of useless without water.
I'm sorry to hear that, my dad says genuinely.
How can we help?
Well, we know you have survival supplies. Hell, everyone knows you've got enough squirreled away in there to survive the apocalypse.
Then he laughs nervously, noticing my dad frowning a bit at the word squirreled, as if preparing for the worst is somehow worthy of ridicule. And just then, I notice that Malecki's hands are shaking anxiously, like he went over this dialogue at his head 1,000 times and still screwed it up. I know my dad well enough to know that he doesn't give handouts. Plus, once you start giving things away for free, it's a slippery slope. And if there's one thing my dad hates, it's slippery slopes. My dad casually, strategically puts his hand on the door. Not to close it, but to give him leverage in case he needs to.
The key word there, Roger, is survival. We have just enough to survive.
Malecki takes a moment to regroup his thoughts and tries again.
All right, I get it, he says. You have principles, and you don't want to compromise them, but I'm begging you, Richard. There's got to be something you can do. I mean, the baby.
My dad weighs the possibilities.
I'm sure I could give you a few pointers, he says.
Pointers? My dad motions toward Malecki's yard.
You've got a marvelous garden of succulents. You could grind those up and squeeze at least a gallon out of them. I can even show you how to make a condenser to extract the water.
The cactuses? Malecki laughs, incredulous. My dad smiles graciously.
Cacti, he gently corrects. You could have fresh water by tomorrow.
Malecki's smile fades, realizing that my father isn't joking.
I have a family to look after. I don't have that kind of time.
Well, if you want water, you'll make the time. But rather than formulating a response, his eyes narrow and his lips curl with rage. He steps forward, getting into my dad's face.
Who the hell do you think you are?
But my dad stays cool, collected.
Roger, I'm offering you a gift much more valuable than a bottle of water. Self-reliance.
Malecki's expression darkens, and he gets this strange, wild look in his eyes.
You're just going to stand there and let my wife's breast milk run dry?
How dare you get angry at me, as if your lack of foresight is my fault?
You're a son of a bitch. You know that?
And my dad's done. He doesn't suffer fools lightly. And to him, anyone who expects others to solve their problems is a fool.
Why don't you come back when you're ready to behave like a functioning member of society?
He tries to shut the door, but Malecki lunges forward across the threshold, blocking the door from closing.
I should smack that grin right off your face, says Malecki,
although my dad isn't grinning at all. My dad tries to shoulder him out, but Malecki has the adrenaline of a desperate man and pushes farther in. He knocks my father off balance and the door swings open. That's when I raise my gun, exhale, and pull the trigger. 3 times.
I shoot Maleki square in the chest, right on target. The force of the blast blows him back against the door jamb. All his bravado is gone. He wails, thinking he's dying. Then, he reaches to his chest and examines the blue phosphorescent ooze on his shirt. My heart pounds probably as much as his. He looks up to me with this forlorn, bewildered look, as if I really had blown a hole in his chest. Then, I reach for my backpack hanging on the rack near the front door. I cram my arm in, shift around, and produce a water bottle I bought at school, when it was something I took for granted. I shove it into his blue, dripping hands. "Take it and leave," I tell him. Maleki looks at the bottle of water and goes red in the face, embarrassed, like it wasn't too late for his humanity to suddenly come rushing back. He turns, and like that, he's gone. In an instant, my dad looks to me, his lip bloodied from the scuffle, now wearing this violently charged expression, and I can't tell if he's just worked up or if he truly disapproves of what I did. Not that I blasted the guy with paint, but that I gave him my water. "This was none of your business," my father says sternly. "You shouldn't have interfered." "Yes, sir," I tell him. "I know, sir." I always call him sir when he's pissed off at me. Then, he closes the door and strides away. The thing is, I'm glad I did what I did. Not just because it has always been a fantasy of mine to blast our neighbors with my paintball gun, but because whether my dad knows it or not, I saw what was coming next. What would have happened if I didn't pull my trigger. Because at the apex of that confrontation, my dad's hand had instinctively traveled down to his belt, where his gun was nestled in its holster.
Part 2. 3 days to Animal. Snapshot 1 of 3. Activist. Camille Cohen has always had a problem with impassive bureaucracy and authority figures. Back in high school, she was extremely vocal in pointing out hypocrisies in the curriculum or inequalities in their disciplinary system, and nothing has really changed now that she's a social ecology major at UC Irvine. The only difference is that now she sees a path to actually changing the world. It really didn't take a genius to figure out we'd run out of water. If you just read the quarterly public reports as she had, the numbers were right there. But to successfully ignore those reports and misdirect people into thinking the problem was under control, that required the mastery of a very special skill set. These were the supervillains that Camille hoped to bring down someday. Hopefully sooner than later. Weeks before the tap out, Camille led a protest at the county government offices in Santa Ana, backed by a record number of participants, all members of her college's student body. But she knew it would take more than one protest. If there's anything her past efforts have taught her, it's that real change requires prolonged pressure and inspired action. Raw, tangible action. Today's action will be inspired by what she sees on the road ahead of her. It begins with shock, followed by rage, because cruising ahead of her is a water supply truck owned by one of the various underperforming water municipalities. The 10-gallon bottles stacked in its bed are clearly visible, and are a let-them-drink-wine sort of slap in the face to an increasingly thirsty population. This truck is delivering water that isn't supposed to exist to some privileged place. It represents every single lie she's been fighting so hard to expose. So, rather than continuing west to the desalination center at the beach, she decides to crank her wheel right and follow the truck.
Snapshot 2 of 3. OCWD Transport. David Chen has been an employee of the Orange County Water District for nearly a year now, and lately, they've given him increasingly stressful tasks. Today, he's driving a truck full of drinking water, and riding shotgun is a guy with a shotgun and a bulletproof vest. In fact, they've given David a vest too. "Just a precaution," he was told. "Nothing to concern yourself with." As if he's stupid. The vest is heavy and hot, and no amount of air conditioning in the truck can cool him down. He's sweating in more ways than one. With all the county's water mains on emergency shutdown and endless glitches in the computers trying to redirect what water is left, he's been transporting water manually to high-priority facilities. Just yesterday, he drove one of a dozen tanker trucks delivering the contents of a high school swimming pool to Camp Pendleton Marine Base. But desperate times call for desperate measures, and water managers are scrambling to keep the sky from completely falling. It's late afternoon, and David is only on his third delivery of the day. Traffic has been getting increasingly worse, and the GPS apps keep giving everyone the same alternate routes, just compounding the problem. Current protocol is that all water from municipal water districts will go to hospitals and government facilities first. Federal emergency management will provide relief for private citizens. David already stashed away one of the blue water cooler-sized containers for himself and his family. One measly container, in the grand scheme of things, won't be missed. He considers it unofficial combat pay. It's reclaimed water. That's what they're down to now. All the water that was still in the sewer system when the water was turned off. All the water that was leaving homes ahead of the tap out and heading back to the Orange County Water District. It's not like they just dumped that water into the ocean. It's purified. Microfiltration, reverse osmosis, ultraviolet radiation, and abracadabra, they turned the county's last day of raw sewage into nearly 50,000 gallons of drinkable water. Of course, no one's supposed to drink it. The policy is that it's only supposed to be used for public irrigation, because serving a litigious, finicky public reclaimed water, no matter how clean it is, would be a public relations nightmare. But now, no one cares where it comes from, as long as it comes. This afternoon's delivery is a critical one. He's bringing water to the workers holed up behind the locked fence of Huntington Beach Power Plant. From what he understands, the plant, which only has about 40 on-site workers at any given time, has become a refuge for Applied Energy Services and Southern California Edison employees. Now there are more than 300 people within its gates. A spontaneous refugee camp of sorts. Hence, today's delivery. As he pulls off the Pacific Coast Highway, the plant wavers before him like an ugly industrial mirage, asphalt heat making it shimmer before him. But he has to halt short of the security gate because someone's standing in his way, preventing him from proceeding. Not an employee, but a girl, no older than 20. By the way she's planted her feet, and by the angry, thirsty look in her eye, he gets the feeling she's not going to let him pass. Meanwhile, on the other side of Pacific Coast Highway, on the long strip of Huntington Beach, frustrated crowds waiting for desalination machines have begun to take notice of his truck.
Snapshot 3 of 3. Plant Manager. When Pete Flores was a child, he always wanted to be a magician. As an adult, he found his magic in the manipulation of electrical currents. To him, he couldn't have landed any closer to his original dream because now, as a power plant manager, he gets to create electricity out of thin air, literally, using natural gas. His Huntington Beach plant produces 450 megawatts of power, which is enough to power nearly 500,000 homes. But, for the first time in all his years here, the station is facing an unprecedented situation. Should he have refused to allow all of his employees safe refuge within the gates of the plant? Should he have refused when other electrical agencies requested sanctuary for their workers? Should he have refused when they asked to bring their families? The Home Office would have refused, not because they were hardened, but because they were so far removed. They didn't see the human faces of this crisis. He might be reprimanded for what he did, might even lose his job, but he resolved not to regret it. He's accepted that the days ahead are going to be increasingly difficult, but the job brings him pride and honor. This is nothing, he thinks, reminding himself of the nuclear power plant that melted down in Fukushima, Japan, after an earthquake and the tsunami that followed. Generators flooded and shut down, and the reactors overheated, resulting in total nuclear meltdown. And what did that plant manager do? Rather than fleeing the scene, he decided to stay with his workers in spite of the danger, cooling the plant using seawater. It exposed them to lethal levels of radiation, but reduced Japan's nuclear contamination tenfold. That's how you hold the line when you have the fate of millions of lives in your hands. Sometimes being the hero means going down with the ship. As the power plant is considered a critical water priority, Pete's request for food and water had to be honored, which is exactly why all the families who are currently under his care came. Now he isn't just a plant manager. He finds he's more like a mayor. It's both terrifying and exhilarating. It makes him wonder if public office might be in his future once he gets fired for helping all these people. Today, his turbines are working at full capacity because both the Redondo and Palomar power plants have gone offline. The unofficial word is that it was the result of employee attrition. Workers just stopped showing up. In a choice between taking care of the plants or taking care of their families during the tap-out, they chose their families. It just reinforces for Pete that welcoming his own workers' families was the right decision. Still, the two plant shutdowns trouble him. If there are any more, it could cause a cascading failure in the grid. And with so many electrical workers AWOL, there's no telling when such a thing would be resolved. Late in the afternoon, his control room supervisor alerts him that the water truck they've been waiting for all day is at the gate. "But there's a problem," he says. Pete is wary. While his job is all about solving problems, the issues he's been facing lately have been a bit out of his wheelhouse. "What sort of problem?" "Maybe you should see for yourself." Most of the security cameras show expected activity on the property,